Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Hi, Josh.
It was the worst decade ever.
It was the best decade ever.
Would it be the decade where you go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC to get 50% off a single item, 3 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, and free U.S. shipping? Would it be that decade?
Well, it wouldn't be that decade because I don't think Adam and Eve was online at that point, so meh.
I do have an old Adam and Eve catalog from 1984.
See, it was around at least.
Yeah, and I find it really funny how I got that catalog. I bought in vintage Playboy from the 70s from halfprice.com or from half.com, half price books, whatever it's called. And I opened it up and that catalog fell out. So some guy, when he sold it to Half Price Books, was hiding that catalog from his wife or something. It was really funny.
Cute.
But yes. Go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC. Now, we are going to be talking about the 1990s. Now, since we already did a three-part episode on
how much the 90s
certain
rocked.
Specific things, we're going to try to avoid those. But there are a lot of things we didn't talk about why the 90s sucked.
The 90s were great.
No, they weren't.
Yeah, they were.
The 90s, okay, I said it on the show, I said it in my column. The 90s were a creative void.
Economic boom. People were working way back in the 1990s. Do you remember when you had no problem quitting one job because you could just walk down the street and get another one? I miss that a lot.
Isn't it weird the difference between when Democrats and Republicans are in power?
Well, I hate to tell you this, but Democrats been in power long enough to really affect change, and it's not happening.
Well, that's because he's a weak-willed do nothing who is a cow tower to everything that the Republicans want.
Windows 95 came out and was very unstable until Windows 2000, but 2000 came out in the 90s.
I had Windows 98. Was that
98
more stable?
Was okay. Yeah, 98 was considerably more stable than 90. I got 95 on like day one. My dad and I kind of skipped down to the computer store full of glee, and yeah, that was ugly. But 98 was pretty stable, and then 2000, I still think Windows has not made a better operating system than 2000 NT or 2000 Pro.
I actually, if I got to go with one of those, I got to go XP. I still use
XP.
I still use XP on my basement computer because the computer can't handle anything more than that because it's so old, but I thought XP was pretty decent. I've only had a few issues with it. Vista, on the other hand, fucking piece of shit.
Yeah, Vista had its issues, and God, I don't know what they were thinking with 8 other than all computers now are touchscreen.
8 is like a DLC mission for a game. It's not really something you can use on its own. You have to have other certain priorities prior to that.
Yeah, like a little program to put your start button back in the corner where it fucking belongs.
My son has Windows 8. He don't like it.
No.
But we're not talking computers, really. Right. I mean, but you brought up Windows 95.
Yes.
As much as we like to bitch about things, the 90s really revolutionized what we think of for what computers are. Just look at like a TV show or a movie that was made prior to, say, 1993, when they started using the kind of interfaces that we would know.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at those, and that's what nobody could really foresee what Windows 95 would really do.
Right. I mean, this was the time when, now, look, the most popular Windows software prior to Windows 95 was Windows 3.1 or 3.11 or whatever intonation you had of that. But it ran on top of DOS. For a lot of games, for a lot of pretty processor-heavy stuff, you quit Windows altogether, and you got this little thing that, you know, C:\
DOS prompt.
Forward arrow, blink, blink,
DOS prompt.
Blink. Yeah, DOS prompt. And you can still, to this day, you can fire up Terminal in Windows, whatever version you have, and it'll give you that nice little DOS prompt, and you can go back to a command line interface, which, frankly, there are bits of the command line interface that I miss, but the important point is, with Windows 95, it was the first true Windows operating system. It was a graphical operating system.
Well, and it also brought in a lot of the things, the features that we now take for granted.
Exactly.
The layout, the design, how things worked. I mean, as badly dated as this is, have you ever seen that Friends How to Use Windows 95 how-to video?
Oh, yes.
As embarrassingly bad as that is, it's not really inaccurate.
No, it isn't. I mean,
besides,
you know,
being ungodly dated.
Unfortunately, you don't get the Rolling Stones. I do miss the Rolling Stones singing Start Me Up for Windows 95. But
the other thing I will never miss about computers from that era are, you've got mail and the AOL starter disks. You know what? I think I could have actually made a robot out of how many of the... I think every 2 days in the mail, I got a Windows or an AOL starter disk. I've never had AOL. I never wanted AOL. Fuck AOL.
Well, see, it was an interesting change during that decade. First off, we saw the commercialization of the web, chiefly with AOL. People that weren't able to get on or couldn't understand it in the past were suddenly able to get onto the internet.
Internet for dummies.
In a graphical form, in a way that they could understand and start either doing business or, you know, email came about and that revolutionized communication. You had AOL Instant Messenger and Yahoo Messenger and all of that that came about in the 90s. And the web went from something used for scientific research and for passing information amongst a closed group of people.
Nerds.
To a huge group of people, which were anybody that could gain access, either by dial-up at the time or toward the end of the decade if you were lucky enough to have high-speed internet.
But here's the thing that I think our younger listeners are really, truly not going to grasp that this was ever something that was part of getting online. Paying by the hour.
Yes.
Do you remember how expensive it was to pay by the hour? Because I think, like, AOL, like I said, I never had it, but on the front of the disc, it was always like, you know, 200 hours free. Now, and it's like, are you fucking kidding me?
Now, here's something interesting. My dad saved a bunch of those AOL discs. He still has them. And in fact,
What would happen if you put it into a modern computer? Would it just kind of, like, you know, would it be kind of like on Star Trek when the robot has the redundancy error and their heads explode?
Not really. It'll throw the basic stuff on there. And then it will connect to AOL, and it will update everything. It happens. But this was the era of, they called it the walled garden. And it was, a lot of online companies were thinking, okay, here's our little garden of stuff we want them to use. You had AOL Commerce, and you had AOL Search, and everything like that. And anytime you left that walled garden, it'd be like, you're going out on the real web, or are you sure you want to go? Are you sure?
It's the Wild Wild West out there, motherfuckers. So, yeah.
You know, but you're safe in here, you know. And to a lot of people in the early 90s and the mid-90s, AOL was the web. They were like, I'm on the internet. And you're like, yeah, you are, kind of, sort of, but... You know, it was.
You're in a kid friendly nerfed version of the web.
Well, they had the not so kid friendly stuff on there too, but that was well hidden. You're right. This was a time when the walled garden was a big deal, and it was during this decade that businesses like Amazon and stuff like that came about.
The dot-com bust.
You know, well, boom.
At the end. Yeah. No, it was a bust.
I know. It was a boom first. It was a nice little bubble. But you had businesses like Amazon and Google and stuff coming about and going, hey, look at all this cool stuff out here. All you have to do is walk out the door. And it was these businesses that drove government and this is one thing I'll give Clinton and Bush credit for, is that they are the ones that really went, okay, everybody needs access to the internet. It's we've had such an information revolution that,
oh my God, is it what Tom Selleck and Avery Brooks used to tell us about?
Not quite. But yes, a little bit.
I'm just referring, that's what's called a callback to an older episode of this show.
Do you remember that, you're thinking of the old IBM commercial that Avery Brooks did?
Yeah.
Where's my flying cars? Yeah, you know.
You know, Avery Brooks has got that Cisco, you know, I'm going to motherfucking pimp hand you. Because, I mean, I don't know, he could be reading Shakespeare or reading a love story, and it would still sound like, at any motherfucking moment, I'm going to punch a Q.
IBM, bitch! Yeah,
because it's just Avery Brooks.
I know. But that's you know, that was the huge revolution, was that people finally realized we can do what we want on this web. And it was, speaking of graphical user interfaces and stuff, Clippy.
Shut up.
Clippy.
Shut up.
Who doesn't remember Clippy?
I don't want to all talk about computers. We got a whole series coming up. Let's talk about the other things in the 90s. All right. Some of the other things were like the politics of the 90s. I don't think any other decade, I don't think the 80s, definitely not the 70s, and I don't even think the 2000s would have ever seen a president impeached for getting his dick sucked. And yes, I realize it was actually more complicated than that. It was more for his lying about it. But let's face it. We impeached a president for getting head by a chubby girl. What's the problem?
They impeached him for lying about it.
That's what I pointed that out. But it's just sickening that Bush gets us into two wars based on lies. Bush takes away all of your personal freedoms, and the guy who revitalizes the economy, you're going to kick out because a chubby girl sucked his dick. The priorities are fucked up, Scott.
I think that's more of a... Yeah, that may have to do more with modern sensibility than anything else. But yeah, I hear you.
But the 90s was also the time of the celebrity TV trial. Okay, you had Oliver North, which started in the 80s, but that spilled into the 90s. You had Clinton's... What is the it depends on what the definition of is. I need to say that a little more hillbilly to be Clinton?
No. But the
younger people might not even know what's the definition of is.
Yeah.
Yes, that was real. And well, and of course, probably the biggest one of all time. You know where
I'm
going.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
No,
Monica
no.
Lewinsky. Well, OJ.
OJ.
OJ, yeah.
The OJ trial.
Yes.
Again, I don't think that would have happened because you didn't have the 24-hour news cycle in the 80s.
And that all started because one channel, Headline News Network, if I remember right. Was it HLN or?
Maybe it was CNN.
CNN. It may have been CNN at the time, but they were basically like, okay, in L.A., the car chase was already making
wasn't
big
a car
headlines.
Chase.
No.
When you're
on,
not doing
on,
over
on,
30, it's not a chase.
Hang on. The car chase in general was already getting ratings on CNN and stuff like that. It was being played on the nightly news going, oh, hey, check this out. And then they go and the car wrecks. And we had the dawn of those shows that, you know, world's wildest police chases and stuff
that
like
that.
That
was at the end of the decade.
That was at the end of the decade. But it was starting to make headway. And when you have a white Bronco going 30 miles an hour with half of the LAPD behind it, it kind of got attention. And they're like, why is this white Bronco such a... Oh, there may be somebody famous inside.
Or who used to be famous.
Yeah, well, yeah. He was still pretty famous at the time. Thank you, Naked Gun movies. yeah, this was shortly after Naked Gun, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, hey, have you ever seen, it's going back to the 70s, but did you ever see The Klansman with him and Lee Marvin?
No.
He is a black radical that snipes Klansmen.
Nice.
Yeah, O.J. Simpson. Never would have seen him doing this in the 90s from that, huh?
Nope. So anyway, you know, we have this car chase, and it turns into the trial. I mean,
it turns into
the first trial of the century.
Okay, to me, the OJ trial was endemic of everything that we didn't know at the time, but was coming down the pipe. That this was the start of the reality TV, facts be damned, Fox News. This was the start of everything that is dooming the societal side of society.
The celebrity lawyer. We can lie right there. The celebrity
Johnny
lawyer.
Johnny Cochran.
And you had
Judge Ito, who was probably one of, I mean, God, you ever see a judge that just said, hey, I'm going to be on TV. Don't mean I got to be a judge no more. Yeah.
Only judge I know that wore makeup on the stand.
That's because he knowed he was going to be on television.
After the first week of the trial, he started wearing stage makeup on the stand. But yeah, you know, you had Judge Ito, you had the defense team.
You had the only time in the world Cato Kalin's name actually carried weight.
That's right. You had the defense team of Flea Bailey. I'm sorry, F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran. Are they both deceased now, or is Flea Bailey still around?
I don't know if Bailey's still kicking or not.
I think he may have something to do with LegalZoom.com now. I'm not sure. But no, you had F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran of the if the glove don't fit, then you must acquit.
God.
You know, really turning this from, because let's face it, American trials have always been shows. They've always been dramas. I mean, dating back to a book you probably read in high school, Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Hated that book.
Yeah, maybe. But that's a show trial. They've been around for a long, long time. This, the OJ trial, was the freaking show trial to end all show trials. They had DNA evidence. If you go and you actually look at the evidence now, you're like, how the hell did they acquit this guy? Because the prosecutors, none of whom we remember now because they were state-assigned prosecutors. You know,
I cannot remember that stupid cunt's name. The one that fucked everything up.
Right. And she wasn't, I mean, they were performing their duty as prosecutors. They weren't putting on a show. Flea Bailey and Johnny Cochran not only defended OJ, but put him on a show.
They made him a superstar after that too.
A huge superstar. And to get an acquittal after DNA evidence is provided, and let's face it, the prosecution had a pretty damn solid case.
Yeah, but they did have that one niggling little thing that just kept kind of dingling in the corner there.
No, you said niggling. I thought you were going racist there for a minute, but go
no,
on.
No, no, no. Niggling is a word in and of itself.
I know.
But it is the racist angle. You had Furman.
Yeah.
I mean, Furman was just this side of a fucking Klan member, and he was the lead investigator, and he made it clear he wasn't letting no nigra get away with killing no white peoples.
Yep.
Furman is the reason they lost that case. If it had been any other detective, same evidence, he would never have been acquitted.
Never.
It was because of Furman's overtly racist past. That was why OJ got acquitted. Was because of Mark Furman.
Yeah, I really think so. I think he played the biggest part in it.
Because Cochran was a genius enough to see, this guy's a racist. Doesn't matter if everything he's putting forward right now is factual. I'm going to be able to color, no pun intended, everything with that brush. And he did. Yes, and he was able to do that.
And that's one thing I'll give Johnny Cochran and Flea is that, I don't know, every time I say Johnny Cochran and Flea, I picture Johnny Cochran and then the bassist from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Wearing nothing but a sock on his cock.
But, you know, they really did a wonderful job of not only
destroying and manipulating the legal system for their own ends.
Yes, not only that, but putting on a great show.
I didn't watch.
To tell you the truth, there was one point in that trial when I think if it were held in this decade, I honestly don't think there would be a jury. I think we would have Ryan Seacrest up there with two phone numbers.
Because it would have been all over the internet, which would have made it even bigger news now. But we maybe not would have we would we maybe would have not got to the point of where it would have been on the internet had it not done what it did in the 90s.
That's true.
Which the OJ trial is also what saved for a few years the tabloid news journalism. This is prior. Fox News didn't come into existence till 96. So Fox News Channel is still just something Rupert Murdoch is masturbating to in his dreams. But hard copy, Inside Edition, A Current Affair, Access Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight. These things were the Cliff Notes version of the OJ trial every night for a year straight.
Oh, yeah.
And these things were all falling in the ratings before OJ. And they all, I mean, it was like an outbreak of herpes for the country. These things were the herpes, and they were flaring up for a good year, year and a half after OJ, because that totally rejuvenated them. And I've read the book of the guys who created A Current Affair and Inside Edition and that, and they manipulated this just as much as Johnny Cochran did.
Oh, sure.
They never saw themselves as journalists.
No.
They were always showmen. And that, I think, is what... Now, reality TV existed prior to this. I think the first true reality show in what we define it as would be Cops, and that's 1989. So that right. even goes back to the 80s.
Yes.
But I think the OJ trial is responsible for what we now call reality TV, even if just planting the germ of the idea or this planting the seed of it.
Look, without the OJ trial, Cops would have been maybe lasted a while, but all in all ended up being a footnote in television history. And then, but thanks to the OJ trial, we ended up with things like Cheaters and God, you know, World's Wildest blah blah blah, and all, you know, we ended up with True TV,
which used to be, for those that might not remember, called
Court TV,
where the bulk of their day during the day was covering real trials, murder trials, extortion trials, things like that, that might be considered high profile. But this is basic cable. Most people still didn't have it. So it was still kind of hitting a niche market. And then, you know, at night they'd have like Homicide Life on the Street and some documentaries and Forensic Files and shit like that. And then they somehow fell into the same hole that VH1 did. Celebutards making jokes over real videos. That's funny, right?
And these aren't even C-list celebrities. They're D-list.
I said celebutards, yeah, and that's the word that you need to use.
But
these were celebutards.
The type of person where you see them on TV and you go, "Oh, I wondered what happened to him."
No, it's the ones where I go, "Is this an old episode? I didn't think they were still alive." This was taped this year. Oh my God.
So yeah, you had the OJ trial launching reality TV. You had, oh, we had two things happen, really. It was, well, they, again, both of them had their root in the 80s, toward the end of the 80s, but they really blossomed in the 90s. And Two Bits of Music.
Gangsta Rap?
Well, okay, so actually more than that, because you had Gangsta Rap come about in the 90s, and that
and
was...
hit the middle-class suburban white boy, which, in all honesty, I think offended the gangster rappers more than anything else, that was their biggest audience, was the people that they were preaching against, which just shows how stupid white suburban teenagers were that they didn't get.
I had no idea that angry black men could get the attention of suburban white boys so very much. And my wife, Dawn, huge fan of gangster rap. You wouldn't know it. She loved Snoop Dogg. She loved Ice-T. She still knows all of the words to Gin and Juice.
Snoop Lion?
Well, no, not until he started doing reggae. That's when he became Snoop Lion.
So stupid.
It's stupid, but, you know, one of his kids gave him that name, so...
It's still stupid.
I can see it. But, yeah, you had gangster rap come up and hit one bit of the population. You had the hip-hop revolution.
Which I think is still tangentially tied to...
Tangentially, but, you know, gangster rap was the angry, hardcore rap. Then you had hip-hop, which was...
But you can't separate these things, just like punk and new wave. came up at the same time, but they're still related.
They have some roots, yeah. But the other one that hit big was the boy band.
Yeah, that was a really sick, and that's one that crossed all racial boundaries.
Oh yeah.
And you know what? No, I won't even say the boy band. The almost a cappella five-person group, because you had all the girl bands like the Spice Girls
that's
and all
true.
That too. So you can't just call it boy band.
That's
but
true.
That but you had black boy bands, you had black girl, but TLC.
TLC, Destiny's Child. You had things like Belle Biv DeVoe, and God, there were tons of they called them the new soul groups, but they were basically soul based. Boy bands.
Okay, I'm trying to remember back when MTV showed music. Let's see, there was NSYNC.
NSYNC.
98
Degrees.
Okay, 98 Degrees. There was All for Men or something. Boys to Men and All for One. That's
Boys
it.
Boys to Men and All for One. Yeah.
In my brain, I combined those into one group. All for Men. Yeah.
I think All for Men was the gay version of.
Yeah, just All for Men. Someone needs to make a gay porn out of that. All for Men. No, in my head, just for whatever reason, I was thinking that's one. That just shows how interchangeable this shit was.
Right. I mean,
you had the Backdoor Boys,
Backstreet Boys. Yes.
Am I missing any?
Yeah, I'm sure. I think O-Town came about in the 90s, and a bunch of there was the English. There were a bunch of like English boy bands that didn't hit big. They just hit big this decade. The English ones came over like One Direction and stuff like that. But in the 90s, you had your little English and girl ones that
now,
hit, and with the exception of the Spice Girls and a couple others.
Okay, now I this is going to be a subjective question,
they
obviously
stayed across the pond. Yeah,
but. What was the appeal of these things? Because now people might go, oh, punk rock all sounds the same. Heavy metal all sounds the same. Gangster rap all sounds the same. Doesn't matter the group. I can hear a difference. Even in like, I don't like gangster rap. I can hear a difference between the different bands, their styles, their tones, what they're talking about, their message. These boy bands all sound exactly alike. If you played me a random track from any of those, I would not for the life of me be able to tell you that is one band over another. These things were so brutally interchangeable. Why were they so popular?
Because they were manufactured to be. I mean, think about it.
So are you saying that they're that
wait,
dumb?
Wait, stop. Take a look at their target audience, too.
Stupid teens.
Teenage girls, for the most part. You know, preteen and teenage girls were the core group, and this was the ones that were manufactured. Well, okay, so some teenage girls like the hot blonde one, some teenage girls like the bad boy, some teenage girls like the mama's boy, some girls like the good old country boy, some girls like this. And so, for the most part, Simon Cowell and company went, all right, let's get one of each and just put them all together. And well, I don't know why Simon Cowell went Australian there for a moment.
I was going to say, I wasn't quite sure that was British, but
little Australian,
you were in
New Zealand, but I was around there. But Simon Cowell puts all these things together. The other music manufacturers of the day put these things together, and they hit because every preteen and teenage girl in the world had at least one boy that they could hit to and connect with.
But then, like I said, explain to me why they hit so big, each group. I mean, is it just the stupidity of the hormones of the girl getting her first period? Or
I don't know if it's stupidity or
stupidity of the entire music buying culture?
No, I think this was just, I mean, you know, the boy band is really perfect because not only do you have the boys that the teenage girl or preteen girl can think about, you also have mom. And there were a whole lot of moms that went, I want to fuck that. And that was why their music sold.
Well, let's transition from that then, staying in music, to the rise and fall of the compact disc. Happened both at the beginning and the end of the 90s, respectively.
Yeah. I don't know if the compact disc really fell at the end of the 90s, but is certainly there shortly thereafter.
It was in decline.
Yeah, it was in decline.
Because the compact disc, I mean, obviously it'd been around in the 80s, but the shit was expensive in the 80s.
In fact, I called my dad. Because I knew we had the 90s coming up. I called my dad because our first CD player, I think he bought in like 88, 87, 88. He was an early adopter of it.
Okay.
And it was this Nakamichi thing. And I asked him, I said, how much did this thing cost? He goes, I hate to admit it now because I know it ended up in your dorm room and then eventually in the garbage pile. But that was it was like an $800 CD player. That was just a CD player. No amplifier, no speakers. Yeah. It was just part of that component stereo. Yeah. And he goes, that was $800. And the very first disc that he bought, Canadian Brass, $82.
Yeah, that shit was expensive. By the time the 90s came around, that's when you saw everybody moving from cassette. You know, vinyl was dead outside of the hipsters, you know, which didn't even exist really at that point. But everyone was moving from cassette to CD because they started to come down in price. $20-25 for a CD, a CD player. You could get like a boombox style one for $100-150.
Yeah, a couple $100. You get a decent little boombox. You got, and then CDs found that price point. And this is, I think, what both brought them up and killed them. They found that sweet, sweet price point of about between $15 and $20. And we can go to Walmart now and still pay $15 to $20 for a CD. That's what killed them.
Oh, their staunch refusal to change.
Their staunch refusal to drop in price some more. You should be able to go and buy a brand new CD for about $3 because they cost about 60 cents to make a disc.
Well, in this day and age, with iTunes digital download, it's actually cheaper, sickeningly enough, to buy it and download it all than to have the actual product with the liner notes and the cover and the actual disc. And that to me is sick. It shows that the recording industry is just going, no, we will die before we lower our price.
And everybody else is looking at them going, yes, you're right.
You're going to die.
Yes. And actually, this is one thing that I've noticed about artists, because I too lament the loss of liner notes and stuff like that. Luckily, we have a lot of independent artists and stuff that not only give you the digital download, but we'll send you either a PDF or, you know, high-res
something to
graphics files, something like that, that you can either print out yourself or just read on your monitor and stuff like that. And I am very happy to have that stuff. So it's, you're right. I do miss liner notes, but they are making a comeback with independent artists, which is where the future is. But the other types of music, punk came back in a big way, and rock
not
came
in
back.
A good way.
Rock came back in the best way it possibly could, in the form of grunge.
No, grunge is the worst thing that's happened to rock, metal, punk, whatever, ever. It was the we just don't care anymore. The slacker generation. We're gonna make music now, and it's not gonna be about nothing. We're just gonna like slack, man. Yeah. No, that was not a good thing.
I always thought it was funny that in 1993, Time magazine came out with their first big cover article about Generation X.
You know what? It's funny, as Jon Stewart pointed out recently.
Exactly.
6 years later,
yes.
They basically retracted that article, and he made a perfect point. You know why? Because Generation X is now running Time magazine.
Exactly.
So they're a little like, hey, knock that shit off. But no, grunge, I think, is the worst thing that happened to music in a long, worse than, it was the worst thing since disco.
The only bad thing to come out of grunge was Nickelback.
They're Canadian. They don't even count. I mean,
hey,
first of all, okay, remember what I said about like the All for Ones and everything?
Yes.
I'm going to have to expand that a little bit. You play me Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. I cannot tell you one from the other. They all sound identical to
me. We've had this argument.
Yeah, they are the same shit. They're the same crap.
We've had that argument. So what else was going on in the 90s? I mean, you and I, we started the decade in high school.
I hinted at it when we talked about the death of CDs.
Okay.
The rise of file sharing.
Yes.
File sharing was one of the reasons that, you know, of course, Metallica and their first of their idiotic moves and Napster and all that was the, no, you're stealing from us. We're not going to lower our prices. We're actually going to raise our prices. That'll show you motherfuckers. Wait, that didn't work?
Wait,
shit.
Wait, it made more of you steal? What happened?
What kind of logic is that?
I don't know. But back when Napster was awesome.
See, I never had Napster.
I did.
I had, it wasn't Kazaa, it was something else around
there. BearShare?
Maybe.
Let's see here. There was Kazaa, Napster, BearShare, SoulSeek.
Because by the time I got a computer that was fast enough to be able to file share, Napster was already getting sued. So it was kind of, I ain't touching that. They're already getting sued. No.
Right. Now, I mean, there were tons of them. And I'm trying to think. LimeWire.
Might have been LimeWire. Nowadays, LimeWire is just you only use that if you want computer viruses.
Oh, God.
Or Emule. I used Emule a lot. Emule. Again, only if you want viruses or porn.
Yes.
But let's leave that aside then. Another thing you probably didn't even notice or care about from the 90s, the comic book speculator boom.
No, I did notice. I did care because while I was in college, okay, timeline of Scott's life. 70s, let's say end of the 70s. Let's see here. That was Australia, New Zealand, first trip to Europe. Through the 80s, I did, because I worked this out. Let's see here. 81 was Brazil and a good chunk of South America up through Mexico. And then over to, let's see here, came back home for a little while, toured the United States through the mid to late 80s. Late 80s, went to Japan, then crossed Asia to the second time to Europe, and that's when the old wall fell. And then for the 90s, for the most part, starting at about 90 through 93, I stayed at home. Mainly because I was in high school and my parents were like, let's let him have the high school experience. Went to college at the end of 93, did 94 and 95 in England, and then came back and kind of lived in a shed in Evansville from 97 on. So
how'd you encounter the speculator boom of comic books?
The speculator boom...
Because, and the reason that I do think this is relevant, not to just the niche of comic books, this is when comic books exploded into the mainstream.
Because when I first got to college, I was introduced to my little group of friends, and they would all go and buy comics once a week, a comic store across the street from the university, and it was they'd come back and trade and read, and there were like 3 days of reading until they would start gearing up for their next whatever they were going to go buy. And I never got into it. But these were the people that I played Magic with. These were my friends, so I kind of tangentially shared their interest. When I came back from... Then I wander off to England for a little while. And there really... If there was a comic book boom over there in the 90s, I wasn't really introduced to it.
No, this was pretty much an American-centric bullshittedness.
When I got back... At the end of 94...
Had the bubble done burst yet?
No, but I was right there for it. Because I went and they had, you know, look at the foil cover and holograms and everything and its brother and, oh my God, it's another special issue. And one of my friends looks at me and he goes, I'm not buying any more of this shit.
And it was, no, see, Marvel is not the sole reason that this happened, but they were the... They were the instigator and they were the biggest leader in this. Marvel Comics in the early 90s was bought by a man named Ron Perlman. I always want to say Ron Perlman, but it's not. It's just really close. It's not Ron Perlman. You're not
Ron Perlman.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Perlman,
okay.
Something like that. And he bought Marvel Comics considering what it went for to Disney just last year, he bought it for pennies on the fucking dollar. I think he only paid $40 million for it, okay? Which sounds like a lot, but considering that Disney just paid $4 billion, he paid pennies on the dollar, didn't he?
Yes.
Well, he was a businessman. He had no interest in art. He had no interest in comics. He was about business. So he decided, which Marvel Comics was floundering at that time, but in retrospect, they were putting out a lot of good shit at that point. If you go back and read those stuff, that's a nice peak that they had. Okay.
Okay.
Just at the time, nobody saw it. He's the one who said the joke covers, you know, the events constantly introduce new characters, hit the extreme market that was big at the time, and, you know, constantly kill characters and lots of overchange and sell it into action figures and video games and movies. And because he was all about making money. He had no interest at all in whether it was creatively good. If it sold, then it was a hit, and you follow that trend until it dies and you make the next trend. That's all Perelman. That's all Perelman wanted. He had no interest whatsoever, and he drove that company into the ground. By the time, because, okay, he was a genius financially, except when to sell. He held on to Marvel too long, and he ended up losing money by the time they went bankrupt because he just kept it going too long. He couldn't keep all those plates spinning for that long. For those that don't know, the speculator boom, it blew up big. I mean, you couldn't buy a comic book from about 91 to 95 that did not have a special cover with the death of a character, the introduction of a character, the coming out of the closet of a character. It was this was event comics. That's what it was. And, you know, it's funny to think everyone knows the Marvel movies now and how successful they are under Disney and all that. Wow, did they just have no success at all in the 90s. They had the canon Spider-Man movie fell apart and never even got made. You had the Roger Corman Fantastic Four that never even came out. You had an Incredible Hulk. You had the Incredible Hulk TV movies. You had multiple Spider-Man projects helmed by everyone from James Cameron to Oliver Stone at one point. They've all written scripts for it.
I mean, would love to see an Oliver Stone Spider-Man in the 90s. Why do I see Peter Parker as part of the Doom generation?
Dude, read Cameron's script. It's awful. Oh my God, is Cameron's script bad? I mean, James Cameron might be creatively bankrupt today. It started in the 90s. But yeah, the comic speculator boom, ironically enough, was born out of the 80s.
Okay.
The death of Robin. The death of the Jason Todd Robin. Because it started, because that garnered all the news coverage because the news are idiots. They didn't realize that Jason Todd is not the Robin that everyone grew up with. That's Dick Grayson.
Right.
So this is Robin 2. And he got captured by the Joker, and this is like 86, 87, I think was the storyline.
Joker
called.
Blew him up.
Beat him to death with a crowbar.
Oh, okay.
But you got to decide that.
Right.
There was a 1-900 number that you could call for like 75 cents and vote on whether Jason Todd lived or died.
And from what I understand,
they overwhelmingly voted to kill him, yeah. Which was just a kind of a sad state right there. But this was also, Jason Todd was an annoying little twat of a character, so he deserved to just get rid of him. But that was the beginning, because when they saw the news coverage that fucking story got, and the sales shot up of the Batman titles for a few months, and then, of course, the Batman movie comes out in 89, and it's the news coverage, and this was the beginning of comics being pushed into the mainstream. And I'm not so sure the mainstream was ready for it. That's why the speculator boom lasted longer than it by any rights should have, because they didn't get it. Sticking with nerd stuff, you also had the disillusion. I mean, it technically happened in the 80s, but we didn't notice it until the 90s, of TSR and the role-playing game market. When the board of directors forced Gary Gygax out and they stole his company from him.
Yes.
And yes, all you fucking people, they stole his company from underneath him.
Yeah, they did.
And then they turned into, like Marvel, We don't care about the quality of the product. All we care about is that it sells a lot.
Oh, you saw the rise of Wizards of the Coast,
which were not owned by TSR at that point.
Right.
Now,
right.
No, actually, Wizards of the Coast bought TSR, not the other way around.
There you go. There you go. You saw the rise of Wizards of the Coast, and they did a good job with Magic.
For a couple of years.
For a while. For quite
I don't
a while
know, after Ice Age,
I know.
It was, because you brought up Magic earlier. They were releasing too many expansions. Every 3 months, there was a new set, and they were phasing out the old cards and reprinting them in an effort to get rid of the secondary market.
Right.
And they just flooded the market, and then they realized, shit, no one's actually playing this damn thing anymore.
Yeah, they're all just hanging on to cards. And then they came out with the worms and stuff like that that were just too damn powerful, and you couldn't play the game anymore. But nonetheless... You had the rise of Wizards of the Coast, and there was a bit of a speculator boom, basically, with that, with both the card games and the role-playing games, especially when Gary Gygax left his company. You had a lot of people going back and realizing first edition D&D and stuff like that is now valuable stuff. So you had these expansions of Ravenloft and all the other stuff that came about with the role-playing games, and you had the writing and rewriting of rules and and making it easier and easier and easier and dumber and dumber and dumber.
Yeah, exactly, because that's what TSR wanted. More sales, which meant the quality suffered. Because you ask any player who was a D&D player in the 80s and is still playing today, what version they use, they're going to use second edition.
A lot of people
because
use
everybody
edition.
Hated third, fourth, and that new one. That they're all like, no, this is this is the nerf, this is the baby version. We want real D&D.
And to be fair, I do play 3.5.
I haven't actually played Dungeons and Dragons. That's specific. Ravenloft or anything like that.
This is it.
since the 90s, but. I've played Star Trek and Aliens.
This is advanced, Josh.
I'm just saying, I'm not a fantasy guy. I'm a sci-fi guy, so I've played the sci-fi ones, Star Frontiers and that. So
okay.
When I say D&D, I'm just generalizing.
To be fair, second edition was good. I know a lot of people that play second edition. Third edition, they screwed up a lot of stuff.
Because that's when you started to see it get mass marketed. Stuff that should have been all in the single player's handbook. The player's handbook was then halved in pages, kept the same price, and things that were in the second edition's player's handbook were then sold as separate installments because it was all about get as much sales as you can.
But 3.5, they kind of fixed it. 4, they goofed it up again. This and then 5,
they nerfed it.
I don't know. But I when I play, it's either second edition or 3.5. And Those are the two that are the most popular out there.
Well, and you brought up the card game boom. That, oh my God, everything had a card game. Star Trek, Star Wars, everything had a collectible Magic knockoff. None of them lasted.
Pokemon.
Yeah, that wasn't really till the late 90s. For whatever reason, Pokemon picked up after all the other sci-fi and horror ones died. That picked up after.
Yeah, but... It started in the 90s.
Yes, it did.
And it hit big in the 90s.
Well, and sticking with cards, you also had the trading card boom. Just trading cards.
Everything had a trading card.
Non-baseball, non-sport trading cards.
Oh, yeah.
That blew up. I don't know why they thought that was going to be a sustainable market.
I don't know, but every movie had a trading card set with it. I mean, the Men in Black trading card set.
Oh, no. And this does go back to the 80s. I've got trading cards for Aliens and American Werewolf in London. Everything had a trading card set.
Oh, yeah.
But it blew the fuck up in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And again, speculator boom. And now if you can still find sealed boxes, these things, for $1 for a whole box of 24 packs. And you go, yeah, these things are fucking worthless. They're not worth the card stock anymore.
Well, again, they flooded the market. In the 90s, people forgot...
Marvel did that, too.
People forgot that things are collectible because there aren't very many of them.
That's the exact Marvel thing. Because Marvel would always, their comics, you know, collectible first issue, get it now, it'll be worth $100 a year from now. No, you printed 3 million copies of Spider-Man number one. It's never, that's never going to be worth it unless someone buys up 2 million of those and destroys them.
Yeah.
You know, you can't artificially create collectibility. And unfortunately, most people didn't understand that in the 90s. The only, the reason I bought all those, I was buying those books anyway. Mm-hmm. I was reading the X-Men and the Avengers and Superman and Justice League anyway.
Now, you've really hogged this conversation about why the 90s sucked. And I
let you do your little computer rant.
Yeah, I want to let people know that if you really want to see my defense of why the 90s are great, go back and check out our 90s three-part episodes. Yeah, because we covered a lot there. We're just going over stuff, and
we're trying to go over stuff we didn't necessarily tackle.
Really hard to shut Josh up long enough to get a word in edgewise.
What the fuck? What the hell kind of a shot is that? What do you mean? You mean I don't know how to shut up? I'm a guy that totally knows how to shut up. You tell me to shut up, I can totally shut up. Really?
Shut up, shutting up.
Yeah, you got the joke. Thank you. The old Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny cartoon. Yes, Bugsy and Muggsy. But I'm really proud of you that you got where I was going with that, where my inspiration came from.
I did something right. but no, the 90s actually had a lot of great stuff to them. Comfort came in. We had the rise of the 90s were the time when the computer nerd went from being a computer nerd to being somebody who ruled the fucking planet.
I don't know if that was the 90s or if that was
that
the
2000s. That was the 90s. No, that was the 90s. That was.
I'm not saying that didn't happen. I just remember that being more of an early 2000s.
No,
thing.
That was the 90s because we had Bill Gates leading the way, and we had Steve Jobs. People kind of knew, you know, Apple was doing its thing, but Steve Jobs wasn't Steve Jobs until the late 90s. But the truth is, you had Bill Gates leading the way, and you had people at Amazon and Google and companies that aren't even around anymore that you literally became billionaires overnight. I mean, the movie The Social Network is about Facebook, but that's only one of a myriad. I mean, there were things like Kazoogle, which was all they did was there were a group of vans in San Francisco that you went online and ordered whatever you wanted from wherever you wanted, and they brought it to you. This guy became a billionaire when somebody bought it, and then it tanked.
I was going to say, that just sounds like an unsustainable model.
It is. It was. But the truth is, the 90s were the 90s, turnaround.
Didn't they have like a pizza at your house or something where the van the pizza would be cooked in the van as they're driving to your house, so it's literally coming out of the oven when they bring it to your door?
Yeah, there was one of those.
It's kind of the same theory, and again, unsustainable business model.
I don't know about unsustainable, but it didn't last as long as they did. Revenge of the Nerds, the movie, came out in the 80s, and that was the stereotypical nerd of the 80s. Suddenly, in the 90s, they were the CEOs with just deep, deep pockets full of cash who were running things right. And so...
So then why aren't you rich?
Because I'm stupid. Really? I mean, I didn't have the right college roommate. Mine were all basically functional alcoholics.
I thought you were going to go stoners, but okay.
Well, no, I had one room that was, you can't have just one stoner roommate, because if you have one stoner roommate,
you've got a dozen.
Other stoners come, and so my room in the basement of Hughes Hall at the University of Evansville, I had my one roommate, but then we had his girlfriend and Ryan and four other friends that would kind of rotate in and out. So that was my one stoner room, but me.
Okay. But, okay. The 90s, do you think, let's just look at pop culture right now. Do you think it was better or worse in retrospect than the 80s? Because I think, you know, our sensibilities, we think the 80s were better in pop culture than the 70s.
Are
you
asking me that question?
You really think it was better than the 80s?
Yes, I think the 90s were the greatest decade to happen to this planet ever.
And see, I just don't, to me, it's the 80s. I think that, and you and I are the same age, so we came up with the same relative pop culture.
That's because the last time you were happy in life, you were under 10.
No, I was still a zygote last time I was happy.
The last time you were happy in life, you were single. Oh.
Might not be too far from now.
I know.
But so let's wrap up with the 90s sucked.
We're great.
Scott's never going to see that.
They were wonderful.
Are you going to the extreme with this?
Yes, I am. Because
I am so glad that the extreme craze
in the
90s,
I could still do the extreme stuff. Not quite so much now, but nonetheless.
Back when you had hair?
Back when I had hair and women. I had hair and women in the 90s. It was the greatest decade ever. Good night, everybody.
The 90s sucked.
Bye.